just repeat the announcements that are up there. There'll be no class next week during the classification of Cesar Osborne's workshop. There is assignment number 2 for those people taking it for credit up here. The other thing is that while we did teach during the workshop last week, because we thought we were short of lectures, now on calculation we see we have an extra lecture. So we can, you know, relax a little bit. So what I'm going to do first is go back and do something I promised to you that didn't get done, and that's Hamanas proof of the existence of the C-star envelope. Okay, so we start with our typical situation. We have a unital operator algebra. So this is a subalgebra, not necessarily self-adjoint. And we already saw one proof that it sits inside a unique minimal C-star algebra, in the sense that any time when you inject it completely isometrically into B of H and take the C-star algebra it generates, there's always a quotient of that C-star algebra onto the C-star envelope, which is completely isometric on the image of A. Okay, so in that sense it's minimal. But here we want to use the injective envelope. So the first thing I want to point out, and Troy mentioned this just briefly at the end of last time, is that if we have, if you have the identity belongs to some M operator space contained in B of H, then we inject the injective envelope, okay, I of M, is self-adjoint. And the completely contractive idempotent projection onto I of M is completely positive. Okay. All right. I don't know what's the right. Well, the reason that is that we know. So we know there exists this minimal, completely contractive map C from B of H to B of H, such that C restricted to M is identity on M, okay, and C equals C squared and C of B of H is one flavor of the injective envelope. Remember, the injective envelope is not unique as a subset of B of H, but it is unique up to a completely isometric isomorphism that's the identity on M between one and the other. So it's essentially unique. It's unique within the category. Okay. So we know there exists such a map. And CB norm is less than or equal to 1. But the fact that we have the identity belongs to M, that means that C of the identity is equal to the identity. And whenever you have a completely contractive map with C of 1 equals 1, together they imply that C is completely positive. Okay, And since it's completely positive, therefore C of G of H is self-adjoint. Because completely positive maps are in particular self-adjoint maps. Okay. All right. So, in the case of our operator algebra A, which is unital, all right, we get that so we have 1 belongs to A, subalgebra of B of H, unital operator algebra. Then I of M is a an injective operator system. So by the Choi-Effros theorem, we have I of M with this multiplication is a C-star algebra. But remember, A circle B was, you just take the usual product, which gets you in B of H, then you take this expectation back onto I of M, and that is a C-star algebra product with the useful norm. And kappa mapping A into I of M with this product is a completely asymmetric, we already knew that, algebra isomorphism. Well, onto kappa of A, right? It's not onto the whole thing. Okay, the point is that it's an algebra homomorphism as well, and that's easy if you think about it. So, all right, so we have, that's not I of M, let me just fix that. That's I of A. There's another one? M is very tricky. Okay. Another one? Oh, gosh. All right. Now, this is your last chance to get it changed. All right. Okay. I could have just changed A to an M. It would save time. All right. So, we have by our lemma, I of A is just I of this operator system, is an operator system. Okay, Choi-Effros, what we've already... Okay, and we have kappa, this natural injection, is completely isometric by definition, how we constructed it. And why is it an algebra homomorphism? Well, what is kappa of AB? That's just, well, sorry, yeah, let's do it right. So in other words, kappa of A times kappa of B is just phi of the product AB. But that's just AB, which is kappa of AB. I mean, I'm just identifying it with a subset. Why is that? Well, this is true because this belongs to A, and that's already a subset of I of A. Okay, so since the product's already in there, when we project, nothing happens. So it's kind of obvious. Okay. Let me make just one more remark while I'm here in relation to this lemma. If we, and Troy mentioned this, and he was keen on the category viewpoint, if we have an operator system, then we can think of it, if we want to find its injective hull, we can find an injective envelope in the category of operator spaces with completely contractive maps. We can find an operator system, injective operator system, in the category of operator systems with or without unital maps. But they're all the same, and it's because of the fact that we used in the proof here, namely that a completely contractive map which takes the identity of the identity is completely positive. And so, all right, so we get this remark. Injective envelope of an operator system in the category of operator spaces and completely contractive maps, right? You get this projection phi CB less than or equal to 1, and phi of identity is equal to 1. So that implies that phi is completely positive and unital. All right, so this is the same as the injective envelope in the category of operator space, operator systems, and completely positive maps. Okay. Whether or not they're unital doesn't matter. They're all equivalent to having this completely positive projection onto sort of a minimal completely positive projection onto something containing. Okay. All right. Okay. So, now that we have this this setup, we can come down to Amano's proof, which was of course the first proof of the existence of the C star envelope. So by the C star envelope of A to B, the C star algebra of kappa of A contained in the injective envelope of A with its, okay. Well, you can define whatever you want. The important thing you have to prove is the key property. I guess you could have called it something. And so Hamanis, so C star of kappa of A is the C star envelope. In other words, i.e., if I have rho mapping A into B of some Hilbert space, K is a completely isometric unital map, and you take A to be the C star algebra of rho of A, then there exists a star homomorphism pi from A to C star algebra of kappa of A, such that pi of rho of A equals kappa of A.
Kappa must be defined in the way, the computer way.
Yeah.
It's not the original B of H.
It's not the original B of H. Now, if you want to think of, think of the multiplication as being the multiplication inside B of H, you have to find a representation of I of A as a C star R square. All right. So I want to prove this prop that it has this property that the C star envelope is supposed to have. All right. So here I have row of A contained in A, contained in B of K. And over here I have kappa of A contained in C star algebra of kappa of A, contained in I of A. Okay. And I have these natural maps here. I have this map here, which is rho kappa inverse. I have this map here, which is kappa rho inverse. And those maps are complete isometries by definition, because we have this completely isometric image inside the C star envelope, and we have this other completely isometric image. They're both completely isometric images. All right, so rho kappa inverse and kappa rho inverse are complete isometries. Okay. Well, I of A and B of K are both injective. Okay. So I can therefore build maps between here and here, which extend those maps. Now, just so I don't confuse myself, I want to make sure I had C and C, but which one goes which way? Ah, okay. So C goes this way, and C goes this way. All right. So by injectivity, of I of A and B of K, all right, there exist these completely contractive extensions, phi mapping B of K, to I of A, phi restricted to rho of A is equal to kappa rho inverse, and T mapping I of A to B of K, and C restricted to kappa of A is rho kappa inverse. Okay, so again, they're completely contractive maps, and they're unital, so they're completely positive. Unital and CC, so that implies that they're completely positive. Okay. All right. Now, if I do P first and then C, what does that do? Well, that's going to map I of A to itself, and C restricted to kappa of A is just the identity on kappa of A. Because at this level, I'm just doing this map in its inverse. Okay. But one of the things that came out in the proof of the existence of the injective envelope is this rigidity property. If you have a completely isometric map, or a completely contractive map from I of A to itself, which is the identity on kappa of A, it has to be the identity map. There are no others, right? Okay. VP is equal to the identity on I of A. All right.
Or you make a PC
and
another exactly
the same.
So also,
but main motif is the I of A. Yeah? Yeah. Well, that's exactly what rigidity says.
But we just for more general math.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Now I want to prove that this map phi is multiplicative on that phi star algebra just A. I need to apply Schwartz's lemma. The CP max, which was that if phi is completely positive, then phi of x star x is greater or equal to phi of x star phi of x. Okay. So, and maybe we've seen that before. I don't think we've seen a proof, though. Let me just show you. By Steinspring, well, you can scale it so it's going to scale so that so it's less than or equal to 1. And then you can use Steinspring to get that, you get a star representation pi, which is on a C star algebra. Say A. Okay. Star representation pi from A into some B of H such that pi of A has phi of A as a corner. Okay, that's one of the things that Steinspring tells you. So then if you compute pi of x star x, you get pi of x star y star stuff times pi of x y stuff. And when you multiply that out, you get pi of x. So those are phi's, right? You get phi of x star phi of x plus y star y. So you can see that this is bigger than that because you're adding a positive to it. Okay? All right. So let's apply that over here. Let me take phi of rho of A star rho of A. And that's greater than or equal to phi of rho of A. Star phi of rho of A. But phi of rho of A is just cap of A, all right? Okay. And then we can do the same thing for P. Bigger than P of cap of A star P of cap of A, which is rho of A star, a row of A. This is for A and A. My algebra. Okay. All right. So, but now we want to use this rigidity fact, the fact that C composed with C is the identity. So I apply C to this, and C is completely positive, so it preserves order. So you get cap of A star cap of A is equal to phi C of cap of A star cap of A. So that's greater than or equal to phi of rho of A star rho of A. And then by the first inequality, that's greater than or equal to kappa of A star kappa of A. So we got kappa of A star kappa of A on both sides. So these are equalities. Okay. I'm running very low on chalk. Oh, there's a box of about 100 pieces back here. I'll be fine. Okay. So, C of rho of A star rho of A is equal to cap of A star cap of A. And similarly, C of rho of A star is equal to cap of A star. Okay. So these maps are multiplicative there. And there was one of the exercises, I think, which was from the first homework that a lot of you might have done, right? And so this is from Mrs. Paulson, 318, part 3. Okay, if you have C from one C-star algebra to another CP map of C-star algebras, right? Then the set C, the set of all A, such that phi of A star phi of A equals phi of A star A, and phi of A star equals phi of A star, is a C star algebra. Okay. So, this is a C-star algebra, and it contains rho of A. Okay. And C restricted to C is a star homomorphism. Because it's multiplicative. This is the multiplicative domain. I mean, the basic thing is what you show is that if you can do this with A star, then you can do it with any B in your algebra, in fact. Let's get this bimodule property. So, what we can conclude is that in our case, C contains rho of A, and therefore C contains A, and C restricted to A is a star homomorphism. Okay, but where does it go? We have phi of rho of A is equal to kappa of A, and so therefore phi takes the C-star algebra of rho of A to the C-star algebra of kappa of A. Okay, and it's the identity there. So that's the proof, QED. Okay. So this gives us a second, or maybe I should say a first, proof of the C-square envelope, which is quite different from the one I gave you a few weeks ago, where basically we showed that if you took any representation of your algebra, which is completely contractive, and then you dilate it to a maximal one, maximal meaning that any greater dilation is just a direct sum, then that maximal dilation gives you a representation, extends unique to a representation of the C-star envelope. And if you start in particular with a completely isometric one and dilate that representation, then you get a representation in which the C-star algebra generates is the C-star envelope. It's quite a different proof. And that proof allowed some sort of further analysis to get the existence of these irreducible maximal representations, which Arvidsson calls boundary representations. This one doesn't tell you anything about the existence of boundary representations. It does have the same universal property, but actually the other proof has more information in that it tells you sort of a more constructive way how you can find them, because in many cases you can actually construct maximal dilations, whereas the construction of the injective envelope has always got some sort of mystery involved in it, because it's just an existence proof. It's not unique as a set, so it's a little hard to define it that way. And then inside of that, you're taking a C-star subalgebra with this funny product. It just isn't as hands-on. Okay. All right. So that's the what I wanted to do to fill in the back. Now I'm going to talk about the similarity problem for single operators. Okay, so this is one of the problems that I introduced back in the first lecture. Question is, if P is in B of H, how can you decide if P is similar to some operator x with norm of x less than or equal to 1. Okay. Well, you know that similarity preserves spectrum, for example, and if an operator has norm at most 1, then the spectrum is contained in the unit disk. So you would certainly have to have the spectrum of T contained in the closed unit disk. But that's easily seen to be too weak. Now already you can look at 2x2 matrices, and there's a matrix whose spectrum is just one, and there's no way that it's similar to a contraction, because it's always similar to an operator which can be diagonalized with ones down the diagonal, right? So if you have if 1 1 0 1 is similar to x, then x is unitarily equivalent to something in upper triangular form, and its eigenvalues are on the diagonal, and it always has some x there, and that's not zero, because otherwise it would be the identity operator, and this is certainly not similar to the identity. And having something non-zero there makes the norm at least square root of 1 plus x squared. In fact, bigger. All right, so that's not enough. So that's not enough. Okay. So we want something a little more specific. Okay. So let's suppose X is equal to A G A inverse, and X is less than or equal to 1. Well, one thing you get, if I look at norm of t to the n, well, that's A inverse xA to the n. And when you take the nth power, you get all the A's in the middle get canceled off by A inverses, right? So this is A inverse x to the nA. So that's less than the norm of A inverse times the norm of A times the norm of x to the n, but x is a contraction. Okay. So you have the sup of norm of t to the n greater than or equal to 1 is finite. Such operators are called power bounded. That's the obvious meaning. Okay. But we can do better than that. Okay. We have von Neumann's inequality. And what does von Neumann's inequality tell us? It says that if P is a polynomial, okay, and I want to compute the norm of P of T. All right, so this is P of A inverse XA. And since I can pull, since A inverse XA to the N is A inverse X to the NA, the same is true of any polynomial. So this is A inverse P of XA. So that's less than or equal to norm of A inverse times the norm of A times the norm of P of X, which by the von Neumann inequality, the norm of P of X is no more than the sup norm of P over the unit disk. Okay. So this says that this representation rho t from polynomials or even from the disk algebra into B of H by rho t of f is equal to f of t is bounded. Okay. And so such operators, if you have this property, you say t is polynomially bounded. Oh, can't raise it up. I have to leave it there. Okay, but we can do better than that. Again, a stronger condition, which is from you have the Nash dilation, okay, gets us completely polynomially bounded, all right? Because you have there exists a unitary U, which looks like an upper triangular form with x in the 2-2 entry. Okay. And so then if I have a matrix of polynomials, Okay. You have, say, PIJ, and then I can perform PIJ of T. Well, by the same sort of analysis, I get a diagonal operator here with A inverse is down the diagonal times the matrix whose entries are PIJ of X, like that. And therefore, that the norm of this matrix is less than or equal to the norm of this diagonal matrix, which is just the norm of A inverse, times the norm of this. And that, of course, can be made bigger by putting the unitary in there. And this diagonal operator has the norm of A. But now, this map sigma, mapping C of T to B of K here by sigma of F equals F of U, this is a star representation. And therefore, sigma CB is equal to 1. Okay, star representations are not just positive, but they're completely positive and unital, so they're completely contractive. So this is just sigma tensor identity N of the matrix PIJ. So this is less than norm of A inverse times norm of A times the norm of that matrix PIJ infinity, where again the supernorm is taken over the unit disk or the unit circle, and we're taking the norm as an operator, all right, n by n matrix. Okay, so this property is called completely polynomially bounded. Okay, and it says, and another way of writing this is that rho T is completely bounded. Okay. The question is, at what point can we reverse this process? Right? What's the weakest hypothesis that's natural that implies that T is similar to a contraction? Well, the first thing to observe is we finally reached one that's okay. Okay, so we have theorem of Paulsen's, which is that T is similar to a contraction if and only if T is completely polynomially bounded. Okay, and he proved this at the same time he proved his general theorem that we saw last time, that if you have a unital operator algebra and you have a completely bounded representation, then that representation is similar to a completely contractive representation. So we saw this direction, so we want to see this direction, and then we want to apply Paulsen's theorem from last time. Rho T is a completely bounded representation of the disk algebra. Okay, so by Paulsen's theorem, rho T is similar to a completely contractive representation. Okay, i.e., there exists an A invertible so that let me call it sigma of f equals a rho t of f, a inverse is completely, has sigma cb equals 1. Okay, in particular, if I take the identity function z, okay, that's equal to a t a inverse, which we'll call x, and the norm of x is less than or equal to the norm of z, which is 1. Let me call it infinity. Right? The sup of the identity function over the disk is equal to 1. So therefore, t is similar to x. Oh no, I'm doing it wrong. Well, time to get used to this system. So this is not a historically accurate presentation of events. Power bounded was dispensed with first, and then Paulsen proved his theorem, and then finally we come back to the question of whether polynomially bounded is enough. Okay, so one is not sufficient. That's arguable, and also Liebhoff contributes there. And then you have three, you have Paulsen's theorem. Then you had two historically, and here you have PGA. There exists T polynomially bounded, not similar to a contraction. Okay. And I'm going to show you why that's true, but it's going to take us a little while to build some background, so I'll do part of the background in the second hour this afternoon, and then we'll do the full details in 2 weeks when we meet. So this is a natural point to stop for a quick break. We start again at 5 past. Okay, so, let me go back in time a bit and provide a bit of background. So there's a theorem due to Dixmier in 1951. And what he says is that G is an amenable group. With a topology or not, doesn't matter. But anyway, and you have rho having G of B of H is a strong operator topology, continuous, bounded representation then this is similar to a contraction to a unitary representation such that A rho of G A inverse is contained in the unitaries. Okay. And norm of A times A inverse is less than or equal to the norm of rho squared. Now that's a little different than we saw with Paulson's theorem. Paulson's theorem, you get rho of A times rho of A inverse equal to the CB norm of rho. And here we have the square of the norm, and this reflects the fact that the CB norm, well, if we extend this to to the algebra, C-star algebra generates in a certain sense, then or like the group C-star algebra, then what it says is that the CB norm of that representation is less than the square of the norm of rho. And that power actually is an important factor that comes out. And around the same time, that it's an immediate corollary of this, I'm not going to prove this theorem. I expect it's familiar to a fair number of people here. And if you haven't seen it, it is in Paulson's book, among other places, and it's not so hard. All right. In particular, if you don't know what amenable means, well, it includes all abelian groups. And that's all I'm going to use today. All right. So we get a corollary, we get a theorem of Nash. And it's credited to Nash because I guess he proved this independent of Dixmier about the same time. I think also about 1951. But what he proved is that if T is an invertible operator, it's invertible, and the sup of norm T to the n, as n runs over all integers, not just over all positive integers, is finite, then T is similar to a unitary. Okay. Now, this is immediate from Dixmier's theorem because you just apply, the proof is just that you look at this representation rho from the integers to B of H by rho of n equals t to the n. To say that rho is a bounded representation is exactly to say that this sup of overall the powers, positive and negative, is finite. Okay. All right. Oh. There we go again. I'm not supposed to do that. I'm supposed to move over here. Maybe I've used the wrong one. It doesn't matter. So, Knox proved this, and he wondered about the case of just positive powers. And he proved, for instance, that if you have a compact operator and it's power bounded, then it's similar to a contraction. And that's sort of easy. I mean, it's true for, it's easy to see that it's true for matrices by using Jordan form or triangular form, and you can't have sort of from the Jordan form, you can't have multiple roots on the boundary because of, like, just the argument that I gave you there for 2x2 matrices. And if you have something whose spectrum is contained strictly inside the disk, then there's an invertible operator, which, so it is similar to a contraction. Okay. And that's result of Rosa. It's not too hard either. Just so Nag's theorem for compacts isn't too far away from the finite rank one, and just sort of the reason that it works. And so he posed the question that if you have T and it's power bounded, is it similar to a contraction? And that was shot down by Fogel's counterexample, which I will show you in a little while. And it was Paul Helmholtz who reformulated it, saying, well, if it's similar to contraction, it has to be polynomially bounded. Does that have to be, is that equivalent to being similar to a contraction? And that's sort of why, I guess, when Vern Paulsen proved this theorem here, that people didn't get super excited and saying, wow, we solved the problem, because he didn't answer the question as it was posed. Okay. Now let me show you one other corollary of Beaksme's theorem that's interesting. So you remember last time Troy mentioned the theorem of Hogarth that says if you have a representation of a C-star algebra, then it's similar to a star representation if and only if it's completely bounded. Okay. But the question is, of Katteson's is still open, is if you have a representation of a C-star algebra that's bounded, is it always similar to a contraction? So that question is in the same state that this problem was in for many years. And it's still open. And you can become famous by solving it. But, you know, there's been a lot of competition. A lot of people have tried. Okay. All right. So if A is a commutative C-star algebra, okay, and row mapping A into B of H is a bounded representation, then row is similar to a star representation, and in fact, the CB norm of row is less than or equal to row squared. And the proof, or is the sketch of the proof, is that you look at the unitary group of A, all right, and rho restricted to U is a representation, is a bounded representation of an abelian group, and therefore amenable. You won't find a proof that in Paulsen's book that abelian groups are amenable, but you'll find one in any book on commutative harmonic analysis, like Hewitt and Ross. Everything's in Hewitt and Ross, so there. Okay. All right. So therefore there exists an A, so that A, rho of U, A inverse, is unitary for all U and U, and we have norm of A times norm of A inverse is less than or equal to rho squared. Okay, that's by Beaksme. Thank you. right? But my claim is that once I've straightened it out on the unitaries, I've straightened it out, okay? Because if U is a unitary, then rho of U star, let's call it sigma. Sigma of A, B, A, rho of A inverse, okay? I want to prove that's a star representation. Okay, so U is a unitary, sigma of U star is sigma of U inverse, because for unitaries, U inverse and U star are the same, so that's sigma of U inverse, but this is unitary, so this is sigma of U star. So on the unitaries, this map is self-adjoint. Okay? But in a C-star algebra, let's assume it's unital. But that's no big deal, because if you have a non-unital one, you can throw a unit in, send it to the identity, and now you have a representation there. Okay? So in a unital C-star algebra, you have unitaries, and otherwise you didn't have any at all, and that wouldn't have been a good proof. Okay. But now everything is a linear combination of unitaries. Okay. If A is an A. A is in the span of U. If that's a linear combination of four unitaries. Actually two, but anyway, it's easier to see four. Okay. People know how to do that? If you have A is less than one and A is equal to A star, then A plus and minus I times the square root of one minus A squared is unitary. And then their average is A. Okay, so every self-adjoint operator is a linear combination of two unitaries, and every arbitrary element is a linear combination of two self-adjoints. Okay, all right. So therefore, sigma is self-adjoint. I.e., a star representation. Now we'll see in the last lecture, this exponent 2 is an important thing. It turns out that that this is true for representations of nuclear C-star algebras, and that exponent 2 characterizes them. Okay, and that there are other C-star algebras like B of H, which have the property that every representation has norm, CV norm, less than or equal to norm of rho cubed. And that exponent is important. Okay. All right, well, let me apply this theorem to give us something related to where we're going. Oh, you put that back up, and now I've erased it again. I'm sorry. I didn't even realize what I was erasing until I recognized it wasn't my own handwriting. Sorry. No meeting next week. Okay. I'm not sure if I defined K spectral sets weeks and weeks ago. I defined spectral set. But I don't know if I defined K spectral set. So let me just, the possibility of repeating myself. X contained in compact subset of C is a K spectral set for T in B of H. If this representation rho t from this function algebra R of x, which is the closure of the rational functions with poles off of x, into B of h, where rho t of f is equal to f of t, is bounded, and rho t is less than or equal to k. So k spectral set if it's bounded by k. Okay. Now we know you can also define a complete case spectral set and this would be rho T CB less than or equal to K. And then by Paulson's theorem, last week's Paulson's theorem, if this condition here implies that there exists an operator A with norm of A times norm of A inverse less than or equal to rho T CB, such that A rho T of F A inverse is a completely contractive representation of R of X. And so has a boundary of X star dilation. Okay. So we talked about those ideas, like when does an operator have a dilation to a unitary, to a normal operator whose spectrum is contained in X or in the boundary of X. And Paulson's theorem tells you that's true if and only if that corresponding representation is completely bounded or completely contractive. Okay. And the question becomes, is K spectral the same as completely K spectral? And sometimes it isn't, sometimes it isn't. Okay, so I'm going to get another corollary here. AB contained in the real line is a K spectral set for T, then P is similar to a self-adjoint operator X, spectrum of X, contained in AB. And the proof, is that R of AB is C of AB, and that's the Weierstrass theorem. The closure of the polynomials in the uniform norm on interval AB is all continuous functions. Okay, so rho T maps C of AB to B of H is bounded. So therefore, by this corollary, you have rho T CB plus the equal norm of rho T squared is finite. So it's complete space. So if it's a spectral set, then it's a K squared complete spectral set. And therefore, by Paulson's theorem, there exists an A, so that A T A inverse equals X is equal to X star, and norm of A times norm of A inverse is less than or equal to K squared. So what we see in that example is the kind of result that people were thinking might be true for the disk. Okay, it's true for the interval, and the proof is because, well, we understand what the closure of the polynomials is there. It's a C-star algebra. It's a Abelian C-star algebra, so things are much better there. But that doesn't prove that it doesn't work for the disk. It only proves that the proof doesn't work, right? Okay, so we want to go back to our similarity problem for the disk and start to see where counterexamples come from. Thank you. So, fog rules example. So he builds it on little L2. So let F be the unilateral shift. Let Q be the orthogonal projection onto the span. So this is orthogonal basis 0, E1, E2. Okay. And I'm going to look at this, the lacunary set. So a thin set, E3 to the K. K greater than equal 1, K greater than 0, doesn't matter. Well, maybe it matters if I want to agree with my notes. 1. Obviously, it doesn't really matter. All right. And my operator T, S star Q, 0S. So the idea here was to look for something that's sort of like that matrix 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, right? One's on the diagonal and something non-zero in the upper right-hand corner. I mean, the shift has spectrum the whole disk. It's an isometry. Almost like that situation, but it isn't quite. And it's just, turns out, a little room for things to go wrong. Now, all right, so here's T. And let's look at T to the N. Well, you get S star to the N. And S to the N here. And here you'll get an operator QN, and I need to figure out what QN is. Okay, I want to prove that that this QN is always norm 1. And that'll prove that this operator is power bounded. And then we'll show it's not similar to a contraction. All right, so I thought I'd write that down so we know where we're going. Claim 1. He is not polynomially bounded. And again, it's not historically accurate that that's what Fogel did. Fogel proved that T was not similar to a contraction, and Lebov, who I mentioned at the same time, there he is, proved that it wasn't polynomially bounded, so it wasn't a counterexample to Helmholtz's question. All right. Well, T to the N is equal to T to the N minus 1 times T, which is S star to the N minus 1, QN minus 1, 0, S to the N minus 1 times S star Q, 0, S, S to the N, star, S to the N. And here, what do I get? I get that QN is equal to QN minus 1 times S plus S and S star N minus 1. I should have done that in the other. We do it in the other order. Okay. So I claim that by induction we can see what this is. This is a sum from I equals 0 to n minus 1 of s to the, I don't know, n minus 1 minus I star q s to the I. Okay. So this is the last term. If I had this formula for n minus 1, I'd have an n minus 2 here, and then when I multiplied it on the right by an s, it would kick this up by 1, and I get everything except the zeroth term, and that's that one. Okay. So I can write q as the sum of e 3 to the k, e 3 to the k star. All right. Where, what do I mean by that? Well, I mean x, y star is the operator of x on z, which is x times the scalar y star z. That's just the inner product. In other words, y is a column vector. X is a column vector, and y star is therefore a row vector, which multiplies by the column vector z and gives you an inner product. Okay, so that's convenient notation. So this is the sum. I equals 0 to n minus 1, k greater or equal to 1, of s to the n minus 1 minus I star times e 3 to the k, e 3 to the k star s I. Now, it's not hard to convince yourself that that is s star I e 3 to the k star, because they multiply just like operators. It's just an operator that happens to be infinity by 1 instead of, right? So, here I get e 3 to the k minus n minus 1 minus I. And here I have e 3 to the k minus I, right, star. Unless, but if either one of these numbers is not greater than or equal to 0, then it's not there. Okay? I mean, because remember, the backward shift kills things off once you go below E0, S star is 0. All right, this is here. Where's my yellow chalk? I need n minus 1 minus I less than or equal to 3 to the k. And from here, I less than or equal to 3 to the k. Okay. So here I have n minus 1 minus 3 to the k, and 0 have to be less than or equal to I, and have to be less than or equal to 3 to the k, and have to be less than or equal to n minus 1 as well, because it's a sum from I equals 0 to n minus 1. Okay. So I've got this little inequality here. So what I want to claim is that if I look at the matrix of this Qn with respect to the orthonormal basis E0, E1, E2, etc., then each row and each column has at most one 1 in it. Okay. Well, if you look at QN of some EM. And if that's not zero, then the EM has to be one of these 3 to the K minus I's. Okay? That implies M is 3 to the K minus I. Can that happen in more than one way? Well, I claim not. Okay. Suppose this was also equal to, say, 3 to the L minus J. Okay. And L was strictly less than K. And J has to satisfy similar inequalities. It's going to have to satisfy N minus 1 minus 3 to the L. And max with 0 is less than or equal to J is less than or equal to 3 to the L and less than or equal to N minus 1. Okay. All right. Why can't that happen? Well, it can't happen because... All right. I look at I minus J. Well, from here, I minus J is equal to 3 to the K minus 3 to the L. Obviously, K is at least as big as L plus 1, so this is bigger than or equal to 2 times 3 to the L. Okay. On the other hand, I minus J is less than or equal to N minus 1 minus J, because I is less than N minus 1. And N minus 1 minus J, I turned it around. I should have left it. Right? N minus 1 minus I is less than 3 to the K. Similarly, N minus 1 minus J is less than 3 to the L. That's less than 3 to the L. Here we have bigger than 2 times 3 to the L. That's contradiction. Okay. Okay, so this is non-zero only one time. And the same argument by symmetry, the range vector, a vector here is in the range of some EM only one time, right? If instead of having I and J here, I had N minus 1 minus I and N minus 1 minus J, you get the same argument. Says that the matrix of QN has at most 1, 1 in each column. And similarly, at most 1, 1 in each row. Therefore, Qn is equal to 1. Therefore, norm of T to the n is less than or equal to 2. Okay. So that proves the first claim. All right. So claim 2. Lebov. We want to show, so this is that T is not polynomially bounded. Well, consider the following functional. You take P polynomial, alright, this is in C of Z polynomial, C of P to equal the inner product of P of T acting on the vector 0, E0 in a product, the vector E00. Okay. So, if this is polynomially bounded, if P is polynomially bounded, then P of P is less than or equal to the norm of P of T, is less than or equal to a constant times norm P, is a bounded functional. It's on the polynomials and hence on the disk algebra. Okay. All right. We're going to show that's not true. So what if C is z to the n? So that's P to the n, which is S star to the n, Qn 0, S to the n, acting on 0, E 0, in a product with E 0, 0. It's just Qn E 0, E 0. Now remember, each row and each column of Qn has at most one 1 in it. This is asking, is the 0, 0 entry of Qn equal to 1? Okay? Well, when that can happen, all right, this belongs to the set 0 or 1, all right? We know that. But when does it happen? It's equal to 1 if and only if there exists a k and an I so that 3 to the k minus I is equal to 0 and 3 to the k minus n minus 1 minus I is equal to 0. All right? So therefore, I equals 3 to the k and n is equal to 2 times 3 to the k plus 1. Okay. So, phi of z to the n is equal to 1 if n is equal to 2 times 3 to the k plus 1 and 0 otherwise. Well, I'm sure you recognize the impossibility of that. No? It's not possible, but why not? Well, sets like 3 to the n, which grow geometrically, are called lacunary sets. And for lacunary sets, the map from functions in the disk algebra to into little l2 that evaluates the Fourier coefficients at that point is surjective. Okay. So I have this map. I must have given it a different clever name here. Capital C. How brilliant. All right. So if I have nk contained in the integers, and I have nk plus 1 over nk, they say bigger than 2. If it's bigger than 1 plus epsilon, then you can split it into a finite number of sets, which all have this property, and get the same thing, right? Then this map C from the disk algebra to L2 by C of F is the sequence F hat of nk. Is surjective. Okay. And so by the open mapping theorem, you get a constant, in fact. Okay. And I think actually you can get explicit constants if you care. For all AK belonging to L2, there exists an F in the disk algebra. Norm of F less than or equal to a constant times the 2 norm of AK, such that phi of F is that sequence. Okay, once you have it onto, the open mapping theorem guarantees that there's some ball, that the unit ball is carried onto an open ball. All right. So, what about this? Well, there are lots of sequences in L2, and one of the nice ones, and there are sequences in there that aren't summable. So what if I take the sequence 1 over k? All right. There exists a function f in the disk algebra, so that f hat of 3 to the k is equal to 1 over k. So what's phi of f? Well, and you can make sense of this by doing approximation by polynomials. You can truncate it and apply that. This is just f hat of 3 to the k times, it's f hat of z to the n times phi of z to the n. And this is the summation of f hat of 3 to the k times 1, which is the sum of 1 over k, is equal to infinity. That's not good. Okay, it's not bounded. And of course, we can do this by approximating by a polynomial, and so that sums are finite, if you're worried about that. So, it's not a bounded linear functional, so it's not a polynomial bounded operator. Okay. What's that? Oh, yeah. That's right. So the next thing I'm going to do, the last thing I'm going to do today, is talk a bit about Hankel operators. Because we need these to construct our common examples. So this is another place where analytic function theory combines with operator theory. So a Hankel operator in B of L, this is in B of little L2, is an operator that has a matrix which is constant on the backward diagonals. Right? Constant on these diagonals. In other words, it's a matrix where these coordinates depend on I plus J. Okay. But I can also put operators in there, and this is going to be important to us. If I have AI belonging to B of H1, H2, I can build a Hankel operator gamma, and this will bounded operators from L2 tensor H1 to L2 tensor H2. Okay, in other words, this is just L2 sequences of vectors in H1, which are squares, whose norms are square summable, and that's a Hilbert space. And gamma has going to be have A1, A2, A2, A3, 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 AI plus J, a constant on these diagonals. Now, how do these things arise? Well, they can arise from multiplication operators. If I have F and L infinity of the circle, okay, with values in the scalars or with values in B of H1, H2, okay, then you get a multiplication operator, all right? You have a multiplication operator. On L2 functions with values in H1 over to L2 functions with values in H2. By MF of H of X is equal to, or of T, say, is equal to F of T, H of T, almost everywhere. Okay. Now, let's just think scalar case, all right? So F just belongs to, say, L infinity of the circle, scalar case. So F has a Fourier series. An e to the I n theta. Okay. And you can do the same thing over here on this side. The operator case, F is going to have a Fourier series. An e to the I n theta. And it's going to have the same sort of bad convergence and good convergence properties that these have. All right. But with respect to the orthonormal basis z to the n equals to the I n theta, it's easy to see that what happens, what MF looks like, and I'm going to put 0, 0 here, is you have A0, 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 A1, A2, A minus 1, A minus 2, A minus 2, A minus 2, A minus 3, A minus 3, A minus 3, A minus 3. They're constant on these diagonals. All right? And up here in this corner, you get a Hankel operator. Okay? So if I take MF, I restrict it to H2, and then project here onto H2 perp. All right, so where is H2 perp? So H2 is all the vectors up from Z to 0 on, and H2 perp is up here. So here we have A minus 1, A minus 2, A minus 3. And then if you then flip by sending Z to the minus N over to Z to the N minus 1, then you will get a Hankel. So this is often called HF. This is also a Hankel operator. And it has this Hankel form, and then for convenience, we're renaming that the two bases as the same instead of different. Okay. So a natural question to ask is, for which coefficients an do you get a bounded operator? And a partial answer from this picture is that if you start with an L infinity function and form a Hankel operator in this way, you will get a bounded Hankel operator. All right? And the Mahari-Page theorem is the converse. So Nahari did the scalar version, and Paige did the operator version. Okay. Gamma's a bounded Hankel operator. If and only if there exists an F in L infinity on the circle with values in B of H1, H2, such that F hat of minus N is equal to AN for all N greater or equal to 1. And we can choose F so that the norm of F infinity is equal to the norm of the Hankel operator. Okay. And I guess the converse here the norm of this Hankel operator from F is the distance from F to H infinity functions on the circle with values in B of H1, H2. Because the positive Fourier coefficients have nothing to do with it, so obviously I can subtract off an H infinity function and do better. So if I started with an F here, and then I apply Nahari-Page theorem, I would get a different function, maybe G, which had the right norm. Those two functions would share the same negative Fourier coefficient, so when I subtract them, I get something with only positive Fourier coefficients, and it's a bounded measurable function, so it's an H infinity function. All right, so this proves that that distance for me. That follows. Now, I don't have much time, so I'm just going to sketch it. It's called the Parrot Lemma, except here in Toronto where it's called the Davis-Kahan-Weinberger Lemma. Chandler Davis will tell you they proved it a decade before Parrot did it, but they didn't publish it until later because they were spent a long time. Anyway, the Davis-Kahan-Weinberger paper does a lot more, but what the Parrot Lemma says is that the inf over operator is X of the norm of the matrix X, B, C, D tells you what that is. And what the Davis-Kahan-Weinberger theorem tells you all possible x's that do it. Okay. Well, obviously, whatever x is, this column BD is still there. So a lower bound will be the norm of that matrix BD. This green doesn't show up very well. Let me try red. All right. Same thing for CD. Whatever X is, it doesn't affect the fact that that CD is the lower row. And the point is that you can fill in X to make that exact. You just write it down. You can find this in Parrot's paper. You can find it in my book on nest algebras. Anyway, you can find it's easy. All right. And it's very useful. And it's going to be really useful for us here because here I have my operator A1, A2, A2, A3, A3, A3. Let me draw it this way so that we can think the picture of multiplication operator that we're trying to get to. It's constant here, AI plus J. All right? So take that and let's repeat it here. I'll put another A1 and A2 and A3 here. Okay? So here you have a white gamma, and here you have a pink gamma. This lemma says, I can fill this in. By the way, it doesn't matter which entry of the four entries that is, because if you turn them around, it doesn't change the norm. I can find an operator a zero that goes in here that doesn't increase the norm. The norm of this is still gamma, right? So it exists in a zero so that the norm stays gamma. Okay. So let me do it again. Let me go down here and put a zero, a one, a two, a three, and I look at the same picture. Here I have gamma, here I have this new operator which has norm gamma, starting with a zero. Here I have the same one again. So I can find an a minus one that goes there, and its norm is still gamma. And I just keep going. And in the end, I build something that's constant on these diagonals. Okay? So you build an operator, let's call it T, with constant on diagonals. All right? And bound, and norm of T equals norm of gamma. And T commutes with this bilateral shift, which is the, it's the shift like this. It has identities down here. Okay. So, therefore, T belongs, let's call that U commutant. Okay. But the von Neumann algebra generated by that U bilateral shift is just L infinity of the circle, and the commutant is L infinity of the circle with values in B of H1, H2. So there's T in the right place. It's a multiplication operator, and there's the Fourier coefficients exhibited. Okay. And so we'll stop there.